Well, here we are, friends, on this Super Bowl Sunday. Also, as we head into the week, the beginning of the Winter Olympics, our primary image from Scripture is an image of an athlete training for competition. And over these past several weeks, we have been talking about baptism and about bodies, about sex and food, and how to live together as followers of Jesus Christ. And today we hear this reading in which the main picture is of an athlete training and competing to win the prize. Now, we had a little competition this week. I forgot to mention this at announcement time, but the graphic for this weekend's series was a picture of an Olympic athlete in training, and Laura kind of made that, I guess, a social media contest. I didn't realize that, but she texted me this morning and said that Holly Mason and Sally Eccles are the winners of the thing. So they guessed that the athlete that was pictured in that graphic was Lindsey Vonn, the Olympic downhill skier. So you guys get t-shirts or mugs or something. So, yeah, catch me later on that. So there was an article this week about Lindsey Vonn training for the downhill events in Pyeongchang. She described her grueling workouts day in, day out. She never misses. And almost everything she does as she works out is somehow related to strengthening her core, the middle of her body. She described skiing downhill, you're always pressing against the force of the mountain, which is trying to shoot you out, and you're trying to stay in it. It requires core strength. So all those workouts, twisting, turning, lifting, that's what enables her to be an Olympic downhill skier. Now, think about this. When we watch the Olympics, we kind of forget this part, right? See them in their outfits just flying down the hill. Like, wow, that's impressive. We see the performance. But we don't always think about all the hard work that went into making that performance possible. Figure skater Karen Chin is competing in her first Winter Olympics. She was interviewed this week. She talked about her relationship, kind of a mentor relationship, to former Olympic champion Christy Yamaguchi. And Yamaguchi gave Karen Chin this advice on figure skating in the Olympics. She told her to be sure to, quote, skate dumb. That was her advice. Skate dumb. Now, that seems like odd advice to give to someone who's headed to the Olympics. But Chin said that this is that when Yamaguchi told her to be sure and skate dumb, quote, it hit me that I've trained my body to do this over and over and over again every single day, and my body knows what to do. So it's kind of like letting muscle memory take over and not have any doubts running through my head when I'm skating. That really helps me stay in the moment, skating dumb. Now, this idea of skating dumb, of being able to be in the moment doing your thing, that is the goal of most kinds of training. The goal of practice, the goal of doing drills, it's not that you keep all this stuff in your head, that you're thinking about it while you compete. The goal is that the training has become so natural, so woven into the way you do your thing, that you can forget about it. You're not giving it a single thought when you're competing. It's kind of the opposite of what's happening when I'm swinging a golf club. I have about 7 different thoughts in my head about what my grip and where my hips should be and feet and stay slow at the top. That's not a way to play golf. So how is it, in light of our reading today, how is it that we can train ourselves in a way of life that enables us to live the good news, to express the good news of Jesus Christ, and to share it in winsome, compelling ways with other people without overthinking it? How can we be people of the good news but do it dumb? Now, back up just a little bit. In 1 Corinthians 8, Paul addresses this really tricky issue of whether Christians can eat the meat that's been sacrificed to idols at the temple. Now, there were wealthy Corinthians in the congregation there who were in the habit of eating idol meat all the time. It was no big deal to them. And they thought it was their right to keep eating the meat sacrificed to idols. And Paul agrees with them. Idols are no big deal. Paul agrees with him, but he still asks this group of wealthy Christians at Corinth to forego their rights to eating idol meat for the good of the other people in the congregation, for the health and the well-being of other people. So that theme extends through chapter 9 as well. Paul is asking us to imagine our community life, people as part of this congregation, people as part of our wider communities. Paul's asking us to imagine our roles in these wider communities as an expression of humility and of care for what other people might need from us. And in our reading today, Paul's putting himself forward as an example, as a model of what this might look like. And I know it's a little bit confusing there as he talks about, when I'm with Jews, I talk like a Jewish person so that I can communicate with them. When I'm with a non-Jew, I communicate in a way that they can hear the good news, right? It's a little bit confusing. But basically what he's saying is, though he has rights as an apostle, he doesn't demand any privileges for himself. He freely admits that his own personal perspective, as a rigorously trained Jewish scholar, that his perspective and his approach to life will be very, very different from that of other people. And so he says, I work hard to meet other people where they live, on their own terms, within the horizon of their own experience and their perspective. I find this to be a wonderful admission of how deeply we are all shaped by our own peculiar background and our own unique experience. It's also a compelling picture of the deep transformation that will be required of all of us if we want to faithfully follow Jesus Christ together. With all of our differences, there's no way that we could ever live together and work together if we didn't learn to become a bit self-critical. That is, the only way we can get along and live together in fruitful ways as a congregation and as a larger community is to learn how to distance ourselves a little bit from our own natural perspectives and biases. You see, Paul's assumption here is that Jesus Christ is good news for all people. That's what I want you to hear today. Jesus Christ is good news for all people. So Jesus Christ is good news for me. But Jesus Christ is also good news for people who are very different than I am. And if I want to experience my life as just one small little ingredient within God's much larger banquet, I'll have to adopt great modesty about my own approach to life. Part of the growth process and the process of maturation for all of us is to find real joy and delight in the way that God's love and grace take shape in the lives of people who approach life in ways very differently than we do. Jesus Christ is good news for everyone. But that doesn't mean that all people will hear this good news in the same way. And faithful ministry together will involve the hard work of imagining, really doing the work of imagining how Jesus Christ might be good news for people who do not share my background and my experience and my perspective. Some of this sounds a little harsh in the reading. Paul says that we are most free when we become slaves to other people. Sounds a little worrisome, right? Sounds unappealing to most of us to become slaves of other people. What Paul advocates, though, for all of us is a life that has been freed from being in competition with other people. In Jesus Christ, we're now free to serve other people and be completely on their side. That's what we're free for. We're no longer trapped in the prison of fighting and arguing for our own little perspective, for our own opinions, our own values, our own approach to life. And now that we've been freed from this sort of brittle posture, this defensive posture, that need to always be justifying ourselves, offering arguments for why we're right and other people are wrong, we're free from all that, and that makes us free to love other people and serve other people with whom we have great differences and perhaps even profound disagreements. So when Paul says, this is verse 19, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. When he says that, he might sound to you like an annoying evangelical Christian, always out recruiting others to his or her own brand of faith. In many ways, mainline Christians, that's us, by the way, Presbyterians, Methodists, Episcopal folks, mainline Christians want nothing to do with Paul's language of winning people into this new community of Jesus Christ, since it smacks to us sometimes of pushy, arrogant proselytizing. For us, this language of winning other people, it almost always implies a competitive spirit. Someone wins because somebody else loses. But when Paul speaks of winning others, he isn't imagining anyone losing. When we engage in serving others so that they can experience Jesus Christ as good news, according to Paul, everyone wins. Those who are drawn into Christ's new community, they win by healing and blessing and new relationships. And the whole congregation, the larger community, wins by welcoming new and different people with different experiences and new gifts brought into the heart of the community's life. So now let me ask, what will this look like for us personally, for us as a congregation? What can happen when we do the hard work of releasing our rights, whatever rights and privileges we have, just releasing all that stuff so that all kinds of different people can experience the good news of Jesus Christ? What's it look like? Let me give you a couple of quick examples from my own life, and then a few things I want to talk about just that you all are already doing. So one example for me would be just the adjustments that are required to move from the East Coast, from urban life to the Midwest, and life in a smaller place. There's some adjustments that have to go on, right? In urban areas, there is, to make things simple here, all kinds of great ethnic food, great Thai food, great Indian food. In the Midwest, much, much harder to find. Okay? Now, that's a silly example. The differences between urban and smaller places are much more complex than that. But my point is that the rhythms of life that I was used to in Connecticut and New York, where I've spent most of my adult life, those are very different from rhythms of life here. Outlooks are different. Conversations are different. People's values are different. And part of the work that I have to do here as a human being, not just as a pastor, but as a human being, is to do the work it takes to welcome these new rhythms of life with gladness and to learn with fresh eyes, to look and listen and learn from all the ways that God is at work doing amazing new things here, right now in this place. It takes effort, it takes work, it takes training. Let me give you one more example from me personally. Another example would be just my own experience as a person who's white. Paul's vision is that Jesus Christ is good news for all kinds of different people. And that vision inspires me to listen as best I can to the voices of other people, especially when those people have backgrounds that vary, diverge greatly from my own. So I am committed to listening to the voices of my black brothers and sisters because their experience of life is so different from my own. Rather than denying my own privileges as a white person, rather than trying to deny that there's this whole cluster of invisible perks and privileges that I get simply by being white, I want to be free to listen to the voice of people whose experience has been difficult and painful in a way that mine hasn't. And so for all those reasons, I have said this before and I'll say it again, I have come to see the Black Lives Matter movement as a nonviolent movement of the Holy Spirit, as an expression of the good news of Jesus Christ for our world, of racial tension. During this time when white nationalism is on the rise, movements for black dignity, for black beauty, that's just what the good news of Jesus Christ looks like in our culture. And I've had to do a lot of work so that I can do that hard listening. Now, you don't really need examples from my own life because you've got your own, and we've got lots of interesting stuff we're doing together. Last weekend, the Good Neighbor Action Team spent Saturday hauling roofing debris from a renovation project on National Avenue. That included a whole bunch of people, but here from our own congregation, I know of a few. It was Craig Campbell and John Hill and John Crane and Bill Martin and maybe some others I don't know of, but certainly others from the community. So they left their own houses, right? They had the right to stay home, like all of us do, but they didn't. They left their own houses to make a house for somebody else, to make our community better. This weekend, YPL, Young Professional League, is raising money for the Beacon Food Program by selling enchiladas. That involves lots of different people, but I know that Kelly Barrows and Laura have been elbow deep in enchiladas this weekend, raising money for a good cause. And that's the same, so too, with the Super Bowl, all of you that prepared soup for today so that we could raise some money for the Beacon, so that we can have more to share with people who are hungry. These are all just the normal things you do, and you don't really think about them, but this is what life as an athlete, life as disciplined, rigorous training looks like, so that you can get a fresh perspective on who you are and imagine what good news might be like for someone else. You all live this out all the time. I could talk at length about the impressive ways that you all give your time and energy in all sorts of different ways so that other people could have a better life. It's inspiring to me as I see it. You are CASA volunteers, leaders in our Next Step ministry, caring adults who spend time reading with kids in our schools who need a little extra attention. So many of you are devoted caregivers who visit our older friends in nursing homes. I went to visit Nate Beeman this week, and Tim and Ann were there already to visit him. So that happens all the time. This beautiful life of serving other people and sharing the good news of God's love can happen. It only happens because you've been training for it. You may not realize it, but you have. We are baptized into this new family of Jesus Christ, and we're part of this practice facility, part of this training program, in our worship, in our singing, in our praying, in the way we study and learn, in our care for other people. We are baptized bodies in training. This is the good news, my friends. Jesus Christ has freed us from self-absorption so that we can find delight in all the wonderful ways God's grace dances in the lives of people whose experience is very different from our own. Back to the Winter Olympics. I'll close with this. The television networks are anticipating another great growth, a surge this year in their coverage of Olympic curling. Olympic curling. Curling is this curious little game where people slide a stone across the ice, sort of like a slippery version of shuffleboard with brooms. The activity of curling was invented in 15th century Scotland, but it didn't appear in the Olympics until 1924. That was its first Olympic appearance. But after 1924, for some reason, and I couldn't figure out why, it dropped out of the Olympics, didn't reappear until the late 90s in Nagano, Japan. And even in the Japan Olympics, they had no plans to televise curling. They wanted to televise skiing, but the cloud cover was too low. They couldn't get good shots of the top of the hill. They panicked. They scrambled. They needed to throw something else on there, and so they just cut to curling by accident. And when they did, they couldn't believe the rating spike and the sustain in the ratings. We wanted to watch curling. Now, why? Why do we? I think it's because, you know, if you watch speed skating or figure skating or cross-country skiing or, you know, anything that's tough, you're like, oh, I could never do that. But you watch curling, you're like, I could do that, you know? So I read this week about all these curling clubs are growing in the United States. There are over 20,000 people registered in curling clubs. There's a new huge curling club in Tampa Bay, Florida that's growing. Their matches are called Bonspiels. That makes no sense, but In their Bonspiels, the bagpiper leads them onto the ice because it's Scottish and you can drink. You know, it didn't say that you could smoke cigarettes, but I don't see why not. Okay. So sometimes we're afraid of putting in the hard work it would take to follow the way of Jesus. But we already have some glimpses of this new dynamic at work in our lives, and we find deep within ourselves this intense new desire for a life of freedom, freedom from selfishness, a life that's truly free to be with other people as a sense of expression of God's delight and God's care. So as you watch the Super Bowl today, as you watch the Winter Olympics later this week and in coming weeks, just remember that you too are an athlete in training, and God bless you. Amen.